So welcome everyone, and thank you for attending this day of mindfulness, taking time out of our lives that seem to have a certain kind of energy of their own. And if we are not very conscious, we can easily get swept away. And years, decades can go by before we notice that there is something missing. While we have many ingredients of our life, there may be something that is essential that is missing. So thank you again for noticing that and taking the time to spend a Saturday in this way. So before I begin, well, I guess as a beginning, so far there has been instruction on meditation, sitting and walking meditation, and there's also been some other presentations so far. So my first concern is everything clear? Are there any questions anybody has about the practices, about anything that's been said so far? Do you know what you're doing? I know that sounds kind of silly, but it's really important. A lot of times people practice in a way and really don't quite understand what they're doing or how to deal with this or what they're supposed to be doing or what happens when this happens, and time goes on. So again, whether you're new or old, anybody have any questions about what's gone on so far? What they've experienced so far. Please don't be shy. Yes. A brave woman. Good. Yeah. Again, it's important. Again, important to know what we're doing and to get the instruction. And again, it's important to get it over and over again because, unfortunately, many of us have minds like sieves. As it is said, as our parents said to us when we were children, in one ear and out the other. And we might have said that to our children, so that is a problem. So again, the reinforcement by hearing the instructions over and over again, even if we've heard them many times, can be very beneficial. Good. Any other questions about practice? Well, good. I hope that silence means that everybody's clear what they're doing and the instructions are clear and the experience is clear, and if that's the case, then that's good. Continue on. So the topic for today in this day of mindfulness is mindfulness and investigation. For those of you who attend here regularly or listen to the recorded talks, know that for since the spring, the community has been in various ways looking at kind of two key areas of Buddhist thought, one which is called the five hindrances and the other which is called the seven factors of awakening. And they are often kind of paired in the sense that the ordinary person is cultivating the hindrances, the obscurations, the afflictions as their practice. But hopefully when we enter a spiritual life and a meditative practice and a path of awakening, we want to begin to cultivate other factors of mind to produce a different result. These five hindrances of attachment, aversion, grasping, avoiding, resistance, anger, ill will, needing, wanting, laziness, torpor, sloth, depression, agitation, distraction, excitability, anxiety, as well as doubt in all ways. These are the hindrances. These are the obscurations. And if this is what we're working, if this is the program we are working, we will have what in Buddhism is called suffering. We will not be happy. We will not have peaceful minds. We will not have happy minds. We will not be calm. We will not be at ease. We will not know joy, other than in very temporary ways. So it is important to see that the mind that we think we've got is not really our natural mind, our given mind that was given to us by our parents at our birth, but is something that we have cultivated over the years, and those of us who are older have cultivated them for many years. Younger people, it's okay, because you haven't cultivated them that long. You got a better shot at turning things around. So there is something to be said for youth. So again, as I said in my Dharma talk last week, we have to understand that the Buddhist path, which is based on Buddhist psychology, understanding of the mind, a profound understanding of the mind that has been experimented with for 2,600 years, goes at it a little differently than Western psychology, which, as you know, isn't even 100 years old. And again, not to say there aren't many good things in it, but as I said in my Sunday talk, and I'm going to go on from that, is the hindrances and the emotional afflictions that arise in the mind, causing one to be unhappy, sad, depressed, anxious, worried, scared, angry, have an anger management problem, spills over into relationships, we have relationship problems. As long as we are only working in their territory, we will never get out. That is why many of us wonder, why is it I've dealt with these issues for so many years, and it seems like, you know, I'm no longer through with one, then I discover another one that's got to be dealt with and worked through, and I no longer think that I've worked through a bunch of them when they kind of resurface again. And here I am back where I started. So again, often people experience that, and they get discouraged. They get discouraged. They think there's something wrong with them. But that's not the case. The problem is much more generic. It is we are... what are we doing? We are... we are battling in the territory where the hindrances rule. Right? Is that clear? You know, we are not in good, solid. We're not in our place where victory is possible. We are in the land of the hindrances. We are in the land of the afflictions. We are in the land of delusion. We are in the land of ignorance. We are the land of suffering. And in that realm, delusion is king, queen. Now, that is a place where we begin, and that is a place we want to, through the practices, we want to work out of. But if there is not this primary cultivation of these factors of awakening, these attributes of an awakened mind, again, the change and the transformation will be unfortunately limited. And we will continue to kind of to experience our mind and life and relationships more or less in the old way, but with some improvements. And many of you have noticed that through the various things you've been doing up to now in the self-improvement world, meditative world, spiritual world, New Age world, therapeutic world, there have been improvements. And that is true. But that world does not promise transformation. That is the domain of a spiritual path. And again, I'm not saying Buddhism is only is the only spiritual path out there. It is just probably one of several. It's the one I know. And so that's only the one I can speak about. But saying that, I understand that Buddhism doesn't have the exclusive franchise on healing and transformation and awakening. It is always interesting to me in speaking to people, and often speaking to people who've either been involved with the Buddhist path for many years or other spiritual paths, that when you get right down to it, they don't really think that things can be all that different. And the idea of awakening, of becoming a Buddha, of living an awakened life, of really being a different person who's experiencing life differently, and to be free of suffering, is something that we've read, we've repeated, we've maybe paid lip service to, but deep down we do not believe it. We still think our best shot is kind of, somewhat softening our issues. Somehow remediating somewhat the conditioning from our childhood, but the idea of being free of it, we really don't believe. And that is unfortunate, because going back 2,600 years to the Buddha himself, historically, the founder of that which became known as Buddhism, that was his realization. I mean, that's where he began. He didn't discover some divine truth. He didn't have a message from above. He looked deeply into his own mind and realized that all his conditioning, was not solid at all. Was just fabricated by the mind. And that therefore one walking skillfully a path can be free of them. Heal, transform, we use these terms, but it means be free. And as you know, in the fundamental first teaching of the Buddha on the Four Noble Truths, his third noble truth was what? An end to suffering, an end to dukkha. Dukkha means much more than the kind of suffering that we think about. You know, the pain, the emotional pain of that we call suffering. He really meant all suffering, which means even the suffering of experiencing oneself as a separate being, separate from everyone and everything. He called that suffering. The suffering from not knowing who and what we really are. The suffering from not being in constant contact with our root. We are rootless in a certain sense. So please understand that the message of the Buddha and the message of all the realized teachers for 2,600 years is that we all have this undefiled Buddha nature. No matter how screwed up we are, and no matter how much mud has been flung on it, it is still there. And it is just waiting to be awakened. Again, the analogy is of the mirror that reflects purely whatever is shown before it. It doesn't comment, it doesn't criticize, it doesn't evaluate, it just reflects things as they are. And even if there's been a ton of mud thrown over that mirror, right? The intrinsic capacity of that mirror to reflect is still there. And all we need to do is what? Clean. That's what these factors of enlightenment are about. Is that clear? I mean, this is important. I mean, I'm always amazed when I speak to people, and people who have been, you know, good-hearted people, sincere practitioners, yet deep down they go, nah. I mean, they really do. Nah, not for me. I mean, I'll be lucky just to kind of remediate it a little bit. Right? I mean, please understand, this is not the teaching of Buddhism. This is your teaching. And we have to be very careful. In Buddhism, it says, in terms of being a student, there are different kinds of students. There are students who have, like we talked about earlier, students whose the analogy is a bowl. There are certain students, their mind is like a bowl, but has lots of holes in it. So even though the teachings are constantly poured in, they're constantly leaking out. You know, it's like you wonder why there's no retention. Well, so the leaky bowl. But there are other students, they may not have a leaky bowl, but they have a dirty bowl. There's lots of dirty stuff in there. And so when the pure milk or whatever of the teachings is poured in, it's not dry, you know, the purity of that milk is not drunk in. What is often drunk in is our own garbage. So we often hear the teachings, and the teachings are very clear. We read the teachings, and yet the way we interpret them what? In our own way. Which is a mistake. Because if we are really seeking to learn something new, and we trust that either the teachings that have been received through reading the words of the masters or from your own teacher or other teachers, if you don't trust that they're true, we will never act on them as if they're true. Again, very few spiritual teachers and masters are in it for the money, right? You'll notice that many great teachers are fairly intelligent people, and they do much better, you know, being a hedge fund manager or something, if they were in it for the money. So why do they say what they say? They don't, you know, get a commission. Why do they say what they say to us? Perhaps because it's true. And perhaps because it's their realized truth. And they want to show us the potential that lies within us. Even though we ourselves may not experience it or even see it. A good teacher, whatever it is, encourages us because it knows that we have the capacity, right? Whatever you're doing, sport, mountain climbing, work, instrument, if we are in the hands of a good teacher, they are what? They are recognizing our potential and they are telling us that we can do it. Even if they're tough on us, even if they point out when we're not hitting the right notes or not doing it right. So it's important that we, when we read these teachings about awakening, about healing and transformation, that we understand it is all doable. And someone who's awake is just somebody who's done it, that's all. Who's done the work. Nothing extraordinary about them, right? If you see pictures of Thich Nhat Hanh, Dalai Lama, the types like this, you know, who are some of the great teachers of our age, you know, how do they look to you? I mean, they don't look that extraordinary to me. They look like human beings, don't they? Outwardly, they appear like human beings. They have eyes, they have ears, they have noses, they age, they die, they get sick, they have to use the toilet. They're just like you and I. What is the difference? It's the mind. Just simply the mind. And how did they get the mind they got? They practiced. They practiced the seven factors of awakening. It has been handed down for 2,600 years. As simple as that. And anybody in this room who practices the seven factors of awakening will become an awakened person. Your mind will change. Does anybody doubt that? I mean, don't be shy. This is important. Because I realize over and over again that people sit there and hear it over and over again, and it does not sink in. Many people have a kind of personal exceptionalism, right? Well, this applies to every... Yeah, I get it. This applies to everyone, except me. And that's our secret, right? That's our secret that we keep with ourselves. Everybody else is capable, but not me. I'm different. It's not true. But this, so does anybody, please, this is important. Does anybody doubt what I'm saying or question what I'm saying? I mean, please stand up for it. Don't be shy. Yes.
It seems like you take one step forward and then two steps back.
Again, sometimes it feels like, or it actually seems like, or actually is, one step forward, two steps back. Yeah, it's not like that. It's more like that. Yeah. Because why? Because our aspiration, our practice is new. We might say the shoots of our factors of awakening are fragile. They're new, right? As well as the conditioned way, the way we've always done things, right, is strong. Much stronger, because we've been working that one for most of our life, right? So that stuff is, we have been working our delusion. That's what we've been working for most of our life. So those muscles of delusion and wrong thinking and emotional affliction, you know, that's why our hindrances are so strong. Why are they so strong? Because we've been working them. And this other way is not as strong. So you may find, you know, again, that you get swept away by your conditioning. Again, you know, that idea of one step forward, two back, you know, three forward, two back, slowly it begins to change. What I often say to people is, you know, who've been practicing a while and often, you know, might get a little discouraged like that, I say, don't go into the incident, you know, but look back a year, 3 years, 5 years since you began the path. Are things better? You look at the general movement, and there you'll see it. I mean, there you'll see that you are changing, that things are different. If you look back and you don't see that, then there's something wrong. Okay? And I'll say that quite openly, there's something wrong. It's like, if the doctor gives you this medication and it's supposed to do this and remediate that, and you're just as sick as you ever were, then what? Either it's not the right medicine, or I'm not taking it the way the doctor told me to take it. And often that is the case with us in the spiritual world of healing and transformation and meditation. We pick and we choose. We pick and we choose. You know, I am practicing loving kindness, compassion, learning to be more open to others. Except in this case, with this SOB. Because this one, I'm really going to be pissed. You know what I mean? See? We pick and we choose. Right? We pick and we choose. We have endless rationalizations that we say to ourselves to give us permission to screw around. Right? Well, I've worked, you know, I've got a busy day, so therefore I got to write tonight to what? Screw off. Or do this or do that. You know, we're always, we indulge ourselves. And I mean, not like that's a bad thing, but if we indulge ourselves, we should indulge ourselves in ways that are good for us. And that really concur with our aspiration. And that really nurture happiness and well-being and transformation of it. That's a good way to indulge yourself. But we often indulge ourselves it's like, you know, who knows? People can come to a day of mindfulness like this and go, oh, you know, gee, I spent a whole day in meditation tonight, tomorrow, just going to screw around. You know, I'm not going to be mindful, just going to indulge myself in every kind of random thought I could possibly think of. You know, because I meditated, you know, all day yesterday, so tomorrow, just go, you know. It's like, what are we thinking? Right? This is good medicine. You know, what part of ourselves talks that way? Not a very healthy part, and not a part that wants us to get better, right? You know, that's why people diet, right? I mean, it's crazy, right? But I'm going to really, you know, really stay on this diet, really eat healthy, right? Very committed, right? And then, you know, 5 days later, I've been really good. Yeah, I've been really good on my diet. Tonight, I'm just going to eat whatever the hell I want. Yeah, I'm just going to really, I've been so good. Did you see what I'm saying? And as long as we're still listening to this nonsense, this childish, immature, teenagish kind of nonsense, right? And here we are, you know, decades later, and we still got this like acting out and self-indulgent, narcissistic teenager inside us. We have to just see it. We don't have to be ashamed of that part of ourselves, but we can't indulge it. We have to grow up. Anybody disagree with that? So again, we don't want to approach our meditative transformative life like a diet. It should not be something that we're imposing on ourselves because we know somehow it's good for us. In Buddhism, the effort is actually called joyful effort. Interesting. Going back to the joyful effort. I'm happy to be doing this. Right? Coming to a day of mindfulness is not like penance, you know? Like, how wonderful that I have this opportunity, right? You know, to spend a day doing something meaningful, to learning how to be, to be with other people who share that same desire to stop and to nurture the qualities of the mind, to look at matters deeply, to kind of step out of the busyness. See, that should make us happy. Can you see? How wonderful. How wonderful that these teachings exist, right? I don't have to, travel 7,000 miles. I don't have to climb mountains. I don't have to endure hardship, right? I can just roll right in. I mean, that should make us happy. And the effort, knowing that I'm on a path of healing and transformation, should make us, you know, fill us with joy and relief. I don't have to keep doing it the way I've always done it. You know, I can do things differently. Again, that should make us happy. That quality of happiness in the practice should be always present to us. You know, again, if we are parents, we should take joy in being a parent, right? Even if sometimes it's not that enjoyable. There are certain times where it's not that enjoyable. But overall, we should always be happy that we have this opportunity. And we should bring that into all our relationships, not just our relationship of Dharma. All our relationships, all our activities, work, otherwise personal, should be come from a place of joy, happiness. I mean, not like giggle, giggle. You know, not like stand-up comedian kind of that. But I mean, like a just deep sense of well-being and good feeling. So now let's talk about mindfulness and investigation. I see that Donna's here. Donna is that's a surprise. Those of us who've been to Southern Dharma, we know Donna from years ago. Southern Dharma is this retreat center we do every year. We do a seven-day retreat in June. Donna was the cook there for many years. Sometimes I wonder whether people were coming there for my teaching or for Donna's cooking. I might have been a close second, maybe not even close. But the other thing about, beside the quality of her cooking, was that at Southern Dharma, there's a work period. Everybody has responsibilities, work responsibilities, and you sign up for them, and many people always want to sign up to work in the kitchen. Because Donna ran a kitchen in which one could practice mindfulness. We need to learn. We are learning here on our cushions in the formal sitting and walking meditation about the practice of mindfulness. But mindfulness is a practice that needs to suffuse our entire life, because it'll make our life better, happier. If it's not always wandering around in the past and the future and dramas and melodramas and emotional affliction, but learns just to be present to what is. And all, traditionally in Zen, cooking and working in the kitchen is a wonderful practice. And again, since we're all lay people here, and we all, unless we live entirely on fast foods, and take out, we may actually find ourselves from time to time in the kitchen preparing our breakfast, our lunch, or our dinner. Please develop an intimate relationship with that process. It's really wonderful. Donna taught people how to cut, how to hold a knife, and how to use that chopping, that cutting, with total attention. We want to connect. People feel disconnected. People feel alone. People feel alienated. It's because we do not connect to what life and what is going on right now. That is the practice of mindfulness. So when we are cooking, for example, when we're preparing food, we are present to the feeling of the utensil, the knife, whatever it is in our hand. We see the vegetable, the fruit that we are cutting. We see the color. There are smells that are alive to us. The whole thing of preparing and cooking and serving, I mean, it should all be done in mindfulness, and you'll have a wonderful experience. You don't have to go to a Zen temple. You can do it in your own home. But, you know, but many people, what? They're cooking, they're talking, they're watching TV, they're checking their emails or text every 3 seconds, you know. And like that whole experience which is such a wonderful experience, if we could just relax and be present, we don't get, because we're in a what? We're in a hurry. You know, we're in a hurry to get the preparation over, we're in a hurry to get the cooking over, and then we're in a hurry to get the meal over, or a hurry to get the cleanup over, so we can do what? Do something more important. There is nothing more important than whatever we're doing right now. And whether that's preparing, eating, whether that's being with somebody, talking with somebody, whether that's doing any kind of work, that is our most important thing. That is the practice of mindfulness. And everybody here can do it. Okay. Please do not say, I am too busy to practice. What are you doing? You're just doing something, whatever you're doing. Right? And if you just do it with presence and attention, you are practicing mindfulness. Is that clear? Yeah. So a mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness is the ground. Mindfulness will not liberate us, right? We can still be a total egoist and still be mindful in the kitchen, right? But mindfulness will bring us into the present moment, and we can use, as Thich Nhat Hanh, I heard a talk just the other day, as he said, mindfulness is simply an instrument. It's how is it used is what is important. Okay? And you use the example of a knife. A knife you can use to cut vegetables and preparing food, or you could knife you could harm someone with. It is an instrument. It's a wonderful instrument. We are learning the practice of mindfulness, because the practice of mindfulness will open up the doors to what is going on in our bodies, what is going on in our minds, and what is going on in the world around us. Okay? So we practice mindfulness in all these areas. It's like turning on the light. So we see clearly wherever we are, whether I am, again, in working in the kitchen, whether I'm talking to somebody, whether I'm looking at a situation, looking, hearing, smelling, taste, or whether I am observing, mindful of my mind, my thoughts, my feelings, or perceptions. Developing that skill of being mindful, of being aware, of being present to, that is the beginning. It is the ground. That is why that's where we begin. Concentration, which we're not going to go into today, is that practice, and we're doing it in the meditation, of taking the mindfulness, in this case the mindfulness of the breath, and by concentrating, by taking the energies of mind and keeping them in a certain focus, that is important. Okay. And because we're going to be talking now about investigation, again, if we can imagine mindfulness, right, as being like a light, right, like a strong light beam that we are turning on so we can see in the darkness what's there. Concentration is that ability to hold the lamp steady. Is that clear? Because if it's like this, right? It's not going to work, is it? Again, don't think, again, we are lay people. We're not living in a retreat center for years and years. We're not living in caves or monasteries. Our concentration will never be, unless, you know, some people are very developed, laser-like. Okay? But again, it has to be better than this. Okay, so it can be like that. Okay. As long as it's gonna, you can point it in the area you want to point it, and more or less it keeps the area lighted up. That's good concentration. Okay, is that clear? Yeah, that's what we want. Yeah. And again, if you can hold it like this, and it goes off, but you see it go off and you bring it back, that's good. But it's got to be better than this. Okay? Because we, in investigation, and investigation is what liberates us, there has to be the ability to investigate something somewhat thoroughly. If we turn to investigate something, but our attention wanders, 20 seconds later, we will not get much result. That's an invitation to take a breath. Just relax. If you want to adjust your posture a little bit, please do. On a day of mindfulness like this, we are sitting much more than we usually do, and so there may be some discomfort in our bodies. But that's okay, isn't it? Yeah, we can bring our mindfulness to that. We don't have to, make a big drama about it. We don't have to let it dominate us, and all we're thinking about is the discomfort in our body. We can just acknowledge it. So before we move on to investigation, are there anything not clear about the practice of mindfulness? I mean, a lot more can be said. So again, mindfulness is the first of the factors of awakening. It is the ground, but by in and of itself, it will not free us from our suffering. And again, suffering here is in this bigger sense of all the stuff that disturbs the mind. Not just the bad stuff. The good stuff disturbs our mind, right? I mean, we really want something bad, and we really feel we need it. Our mind gets so unsettled and getting it and wanting to get it and thinking about getting it and afraid of not getting it and getting it and afraid of losing it. I mean, all that stuff is very disturbing to the mind, too. Disturbs equanimity. So these afflictions are around all sides. So the second factor of investigation is quite simply it is important that we see what's really going on. It's important that we really see how things really are. So we know what's going on. We know what needs to be changed, what needs to be kept, what needs to be weakened, what needs to be sustained, what needs to be strengthened. Now, how do we know all this unless we investigate, we look into? Thich Nhat Hanh calls a practice of investigation deep looking. I mean, it just makes sense, right? Investigation. That's what the car mechanic does, right? Before he starts taking things apart, he investigates. She investigates. Right? Is that clear? It's very simple. There's a problem. Let's investigate to see what's causing it. What's sustaining it? Why it keeps happening? That's why we go to the doctors, right? We hope that the doctor, when we give them our symptoms, will investigate, ask questions, look into, so we can find the causes of why we're feeling the way we're feeling, and hopefully in that there'll be a solution. So investigation is paramount in the path of liberation. Now, what are we investigating? Well, the main thing we're investigating is ourselves. And again, those who hang around here know that is something that I point out is very difficult for many of us. We like investigating everybody else. That's our specialty. Right? We are very good at investigating everybody else and helping them see what's causing them their problems, and you know. Right? We do that as pros. We love that. But many of us are very bad at investigating ourselves. With that same objectivity, with that same interest, curiosity, that we bring to the issues of others. This is an important thing that I cannot stress enough. This path is very different from the way we usually do it. In this path, we are investigating our own experience. That is our focus. And rather than going on the way we've always gone on, we are stopping and we are looking into the phenomena of our own experience. So we see it clearly, what it is, what's really going on. So we come out of the world of delusion. Delusion is what? False ideas, right? It's a delusion, false ideas about reality. We want to come out of the world of delusion and see things as they really are, not as we think they are. And in the Buddhist path of investigation, there are sort of two ways. One way is sort of intellectual, analytical. One can use one's analytical powers to investigate reality, but also one can directly, experientially, investigate reality. So what are we investigating? So let's say we have an emotion, right? I'm going to keep it kind of simple. Let's say we have an emotion. We are what? We're angry. Okay. Everybody clear about that one? We know that one. All right, we are angry. Okay? And usually what do? We just go with it. Right? We love to go with them. Right? We just get angrier and angrier, and we keep repeating the story over and over again, and we become better, they become worse, you know, it's really... And it just, it's a grand old time we're having. Getting angrier and angrier, more and more self-justified. Yeah, right? That's the way we do it. In that case, what are we developing? Our capacity to be angry. And that will leave a deep impression on our mind, and if there's 25,000 other ones that we've been working in the past, it only strengthens it. Okay? What do we do now? Mindfulness reveals to us what? There is anger within me. Mindfulness reveals to me there is anger present within me, in my body mind. And rather than being dragged by the nose by our habit energies, the way we have always done it, right? Mindfulness stopping investigation can liberate us. But it's a turning. And what I want to say to you is that turning is very difficult for us. Because we're used to what? Just going with it. Right? We don't even look. We don't even look to see. You know that famous analogy of, you know, the dog and the lion, right? You know, goes back to the Buddha's time. You know the dog, you know, you keep throwing a stick, and the dog runs after it, right? Anybody ever dog? I mean, you know, you could forever. You know, I mean, they just love it, right? You know, the trick, they bring it back to you. They throw it again. They run out. You know what I mean? They keep running. You know, they keep following the stick. But it is said, when someone throws the stick toward the lion just turns its head and look to see who threw that stick. Right? A very different response. And that's a very traditional way of saying, are we just like the habit energy dogs, or are we lions? Right? Just because somebody throws a stick, does it mean we have to run after it? Think about that. Just because somebody's angry at us, do we have to get angry at them? Right? Just because somebody does or says something, do we have to do and say something, you know? Right? Just because a thought arose in my mind that I'm a this, I'm a that, or this is good, or this is bad, do I have to follow it? Right? Well, traditionally, that's what we do. A good thought arises in our mind, we feel good. A bad thought in our mind, it's bad. You know, the thought tells us everything's great, we're happy. The thought tells us everything's terrible, we're unhappy. Right? We're like that dog. No matter what our mind throws up, we're just following it. Is that clear? That's what's going on. Mindfulness allows us to go, oh, somebody just threw a stick. Right? Pause. That's interesting. Another stick comes whizzing by. I wonder who threw that stick. Right? And that turning is the key. That stop, that mindfulness, stopping, not reacting the way, because whenever we're reacting, we're always reacting from what? The way from our conditioning, from our past. Nothing new will ever come. Nothing new will ever come from our conditioning, from our habit energy, because it has its own energy, which is based on the past. Is that clear? So, yes. We just say, she's, well, what happens on those ones where you go 0 to 60, and it's just like that, and you're inflamed? What is your name?
Sarah.
What I would say to you is, Sarah, it appears to go from 0 to 60, but that is not really what's happening. I would say to you, Sarah, and I don't even know you, so I can just say it. I would say to you that if that is the case, there is probably on an ongoing subliminal background basis a low fire, okay? That we are not attentive to because it seems so normal. And whether that normality for us is kind of low level, very low level resistance, ill will, frustration, just kind of that kind of life, or whether it's worry, concern, or whether it's always a little sad, you know. And these situations where it blows up like that is just because, you know, here comes the wind. And when the wind comes, that habit energy in us that's always there, and you're right, I mean, when that there, that's another kind of intervention. Right? When a little piece of paper is on fire, I don't have to call the fire department to put it out, do I? I don't get a call, I can handle it. But if I ignore it, and the whole, you know, whole room goes up in smoke, well, then I got to call the fire department. Okay. we have to, mindfulness will reveal what I'm talking about. As you begin to watch your mind in this investigatory way during the day, you will see that there's a lot going on that we are totally not in touch with. It just seems normal. Yeah, it is that capacity of mindfulness, stopping, and turning. Turning means looking into, investigating. What is this? For example, what is anger? I mean, if I asked, anybody in here ever been angry? And everybody raises their hand. Okay. Is there anybody who has never been angry? So they don't know what I'm talking about. Okay. But if I said to you, well, what is anger? When you look directly at anger, what is it? Is it a thing? Is there a thing called anger? You know? And what is it that really supports the arousal of anger in me? What are the causes? Where's it coming from? Right? Why did I get angry? Sarah, why did you get angry? If you just stop and looked into it, not blaming the other person. Oh, that's another thing we forgot to mention. You got to stop doing that. If you're still thinking that they made me angry, they're the cause of our anger, that's the realm of delusion. Feelings arise within our own mind. Is that clear? I mean, this stuff is very simple, but it's deep. Yeah. Feelings arise within our own mind. And unless you think that the person who you're thinking is the cause of it has some kind of extraordinary powers, psychic, extraterrestrial powers, that they can send those emotions and thoughts inside you. Right? Sort of like people who believe aliens are telepathically programming them. Unless you really believe that, and we have to be willing to say, anger's arising in me, in my mind. Now, if you looked into it, Sarah, what is it? What if you investigated that? What caused that to arise? Well, that's an interpretation of why. So, somebody did something. Somebody did something. Somebody, was it a verbal communication or what? Well done. How'd you say delete it and move on? I won't go into that. I mean, I have certain rules about emails, but so somebody sent you an email. Okay, well, let's don't even go there.
Yeah,
but all right. Well, hold on. No. See, that's why you got so angry, because you made it more than what it was. In reality, and I'm just talking to you as if you're somebody who wants to live in reality. Is that the case? All right, I mean, you know, I just. Because if you said no, I really, you know, I don't care about reality or facts at all. I just, you know, what I just want to believe whatever I want to believe. Then you and I, there's no reason to talk. But it. Okay, so you want to live in reality? Good. No, we laugh, but you know, there are a lot of people who don't live in reality, and are quite proud of it. So you want to live in reality. In reality, Sarah, you received an email. Is that's all that happened? Okay. When Sarah read that email, was she happy? No. How was she? Angry. Okay, so let's look. We're going to investigate, right? Remember, this is our practice. In the old practice, we just get angry, right? And they'd be complete, you know, we'd have names for them, right? Lots of names for them. And, you know, they're right, we're good, they're bad, right? I mean, that's our old way. And we would just get angrier and angrier, right? Okay.
But that was the way when this happened.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So. Now we are stopping. Sarah is acknowledging that there is anger has arisen in her, right? And she's holding that anger and maybe calming it so it's not so strong. And when she's calmer, she looks into it, right? What is the source of my anger? You receive an email. In Sarah's world, right? In Sarah's world, are people allowed to send emails like you receive to you? No. No. Right. They're not allowed. That's why we get angry. Now, we may have all kinds of subsidiary issues about control, you know what I mean? There's lots of that stuff. But if we look deeply into it, the simple truth is we got angry because something happened that we believe strongly should not happen. Right? And there we are. The self. And again, Sarah, you were just kind enough to use your example. I mean, all of us can identify with and even make you look like a saint compared to some of the stuff we've done. So I just want to go on record. I appreciate you. But, yeah. So when we look deeply, we will see that self and self-identity and these rules and control are often, all the time, at the root of our emotional affliction. Right? Because if there was no self, no, Sarah's universe in control, then all it would have been was an email that said something that Sarah would either respond to or not respond to, right? Right? I mean, after you work through all the anger, you know, all the emotionality that comes up, once that's all worked through, that's where you're going to be anyhow, right? But somehow, because of the way we've been doing things our whole life, we think we got to go through all that emotional affliction stuff, don't we? To get to the same point we could have gotten to right away, which is, oh, so that's the way he or she sees it. Right? That's all. And Sarah, I think you're a fairly rational person. In this world, are people allowed to see things differently than you do? That's a yes or no question. What? Well, I mean, if you said no, we'd be in a different world, you know, so I just want to make sure. So you acknowledge that in this world, there may be other people who see things differently than you do, have their own opinion, their own issues, their own whatever, right? Okay. But can you see we have created this self-world with all its rules and right and wrong of what people can say and what people can't say and what people should do and what people can't do and what people, how people show up and how they're not, you know what I mean? It's endless, right? And so that's why we have all this emotional stuff going on. And whether it's anger or fear, it's all the same. Sadness, despair, you know. I mean, we may think, I should have never had the childhood I've had. Right? But how could we not have had the childhood we had? That was our childhood. Those were our parents. They were created by their own causes and conditions, right? But we will spend endless, endless energy with that sense of what should and should not be, rather than living in reality. So this investigation can liberate us. But first there's mindfulness, then there's stopping, and then a willingness. And I'm just using this as one example, to look deeply into causation. Or even, you know, what is a thought? Buddhist meditators are given that question. What is a thought? If you look right at a thought, what is it? If you look right at an emotion, what is it? You know, what is it really? Not what we think it is. It's, you know, investigation. Endless thoughts from morning till night arising and passing in our mind. Do we ever stop and go, what is a thought? Where do they come from? Is there really somebody sending them? You know, I hear a voice in my head. Who's speaking? Oh, I got to turn and look. Is there really somebody speaking back there? And if they are, is it somebody worth listening to? You know, I mean, stuff we would do all the time in reality, but we never stop and turn and go, where's that coming from? So investigation is a wonderful practice. And the fruits of it will be freedom. But if we never stop and investigate our own experience, look deeply into it. And again, we are so habituated to just going with the stuff. Thought arises, feeling arises, and we just go with it. Mind tells us this, mind tells us that, blah, 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 and we just go with it. We never stop, hold it in mindfulness, and look into it. What is this? Like the lion. Right? It doesn't have to go quick. The lion's very, you know, the king of beasts, right? It turns its head very slowly and just looks. That's the way we need to practice. To feel your own nobility, Sarah. To identify with your own nobility. Right. So when these hot stuff arise, we don't have to go with them. We turn in this purity of our mind, this well-being. Right. We turn it in for what? Emotionality, out of control emotionality, that only brings what? Suffering. Right? I mean, if I said to you, when you are really angry, are you happy? No. When you are worried, are you happy? When you're in despair and down, are you happy? No. That's why they're called painful emotions. And yet we jump into them. You know, with great abandon. Somebody had a question. Is anything not clear? So, as a practice, investigation or insight is a whole body of practice within the Buddhist meditative tradition. Again, it is based on having developed a capacity at mindfulness and concentration, so we can see what's going on and we can stop, right? And then we can hold that light of mindfulness in a steady way to look at something, to look into something. This is the meditative life. This is the path of awareness, life. This is the path of healing and transformation. This is that life. It is a life that is primarily looking at oneself and doing the work that is necessary to heal and transform and awaken the factors that will support us in being happy. And then in relationship to all the others, who in the past we saw as causes of our unhappiness, we now understand that we are in their life to be causes of happiness for them if we can. We're not here to duke it out. We're here to be a source of happiness to others. And we will be much better able to be a source of happiness to others when we have uprooted a lot of our own stuff. When we understand, believe me, when you understand deeply your own mind, your own experience, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, conditioning, when you understand what they are and you know how to heal and transform them, you will understand how to help everyone who wants to be helped, that is. Because minds, human minds, have a lot of similarities. So that is why in the path of the Bodhisattva, the enlightened being, it is said that it is our own enlightenment which is the greatest gift that we can give to this world. As opposed to thinking somehow, this internal introspective work on myself is somehow selfish. No, it is most important. Because when you have done this work, then you will have real gifts to give everyone. I mean, not just like the world, but the people who you are closest to. If we stop living from reactivity, conditioning, delusion, and really act from insight and wisdom and mindfulness and awareness, our lives will be vastly different. Even though outwardly they may appear the same, we may still look the same. Can't promise that you'll look better, that you won't age, that you won't get sick. That's normal. Any questions? Yes.
It seems like when you are investigating your emotion, you have a lot of questions to ask yourself. And to me, as somebody new in the practice,
yes,
it seems insurmountable. It seems exhausting.
No. Well, then I'm glad you asked me that question. So give me an example of what emotion you may want to, or what mind state you may want to investigate.
I don't know that it's just a particular emotion, it's just the process.
Okay, but let's be practical. Just give me anything. Such as what? What might you want to investigate? Okay. So, I don't know. I mean, let's say you want to focus on what I was just talking with Sarah about. That most of my emotionality comes from a belief in a separate self that wants to be in control of everything. Okay? And let's say you wanted to investigate whether that's true. Okay? And that's a good one, because it's, you will now watch your mind. And every time you see it getting agitated, upset, or, in any way, you'll say, is that true? Rather than kind of going with it, you'll kind of turn within and you'll just use that one question, right, to examine, is that true? Is it, the reason I'm agitated because something's happening that I don't want to happen, right? Or something didn't happen, and in my rule book, it should have happened. So you're just investigating, is that true that, let's say, the ego is at the center of my emotion, you know, my agitation, mental agitation. So it's just one, it's not like, it's not like 25 questions. Right, and you want a good question that you can use in lots of areas. Right, so let's say you wanted to investigate emotions. What is an or thought? You know, so therefore, every thought is open to investigation. What is this? And again, not answering it intellectually, but actually looking at a thought. You know, is it really a thing? You know, what is a thought? Have you ever had thoughts, Jeff? Absolutely. But if I said, what are they? What is it? I mean, not intellectually like the textbook answer, but as your experience, when you look at them, what do they look like? There. Well, that's interesting. You see? You see how your investigation of is showing you something that you would have never thought was true. Right? Because we think they're real, solid things. But when you look at them, you see just what you said. There's really nothing there.
Maybe my views can make from attendance. I know I've heard in the past, don't take things personal. You know, okay, who's this I that is being offended? So occasionally I will say that to myself.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful thing that I've heard here, maybe it's just pouring a little bit of water on the flames that are burning deep down within.
What? I missed that one.
It's pouring just a little water. It's mitigating the negative.
Right, but you want, but we want to ask big questions that give big answers so we can really see how this is true everywhere. Right. You just don't want to go situation by situation, but you can use what you learn in a situation to then go, you know, I mean, it's not just today for the first time I get angry. You know, I mean, it happens quite a bit. And if it's not anger, it's irritation, it's a little frustration, a little ill will, you know, is the source of all of that the same? That I just will not accept life as it is, people as they are, situations as they are. I'm just not open because I'm living from self, you know? Oh, well, that's a big one, right? And if I get the answer to that one, some significant change can begin to happen in my life. Right? So this investigation, you know, the result of investigation is wisdom. And the result of cultivating wisdom is equanimity, ease, you know, good things.